steps you have to take. Then it's just persistence that gets you there. And his old friends? Those other kids gave up on themselves. They thought they didn't have what it takes to go to college. The only way they knew how to get respect was with a handgun. A lack of initiative typifies those who feel a certain hopelessness, that their best efforts won't really make a difference. So, like the chemist's childhood friends, they don't push themselves. They see themselves as victims or passive pawns in the game of life, rather than master of their fate. The chemist's resilience may have owed more than he realized to the character lessons learned from his grandparents and aunt, but whatever its roots, those with initiative feel their own actions determine their future. These attitudes, in turn, determine how well we can deal with hardships and vicissitudes on the job. For example, among mid-level managers at a large corporation, those who saw themselves as masters of their fate were less fazed by difficult challenges and more positive in the face of stresses than were those who saw their destiny as being outside their control. Those who lack initiative are most likely to give up on themselves and their jobs. This attitude can be seen in workers who need someone to direct them in performing their assignments. When it comes to going the extra mile, for example, staying late to get a priority project finished on time, or putting their own work aside to help someone else, such workers will often take a not-my-job line of resistance. Too much initiative. While initiative is generally laudable, it needs to be balanced with social awareness in order to avoid unintended negative consequences. Take the vice president of marketing at a large consumer products company, who discovered that one of his sales reps was unable to close a sale with a large national account. The VP had made many presentations to that same account in the past, and so on his own initiative, he called and set up a meeting there. Then he phoned the sales rep with instructions to meet him at the account's office the next day. One result of the VP's initiative was that they made the sale. Another, unintended result was that the sales rep was deeply humiliated. Feeling he had been made to look foolish and incompetent in front of his client, the rep protested, and his two bosses, the regional and the national sales managers, fired off irate memos to the vice president, claiming he had stepped out of bounds in going over their heads and humiliating their staffer. But the warning had no effect. The same pattern continued for 2 years, with the VP acting high-handedly with other sales reps, until the president of the company, worried about a slump in sales, blamed it on the VP's demoralization of the company's sales force. The net result? The president gave the VP a choice: leave the company or step down to take a regional sales job. Bosses who micromanage, who take control over small details best left to subordinates, may seem to have initiative, but they lack a basic awareness of how their actions affect other people. Initiative without empathy or a sense of the bigger picture can be destructive and typifies managers who perform poorly. Persisting and bouncing back. Two executives were both refused a promotion because of negative evaluations from a superior. One reacted to the setback with rage and fantasies of killing his boss. He complained to anyone who would listen, and he went on a drinking binge. "It seemed like my life was over," he said later. He avoided his boss, lowering his head when they passed in the hall. "Even though I was angry and felt cheated," he adds, "deep down I fear that he was right, that I am sort of worthless, that I had failed, and there was nothing I could do to change that." The other passed-over executive was also stunned and angry, but he had a more open-minded perspective. "I can't say I was surprised, really. He and I have such different ideas, and we've argued a lot." This executive went home and talked over the setback with his wife to figure out what had gone wrong and what he could do about it. Engaging in some introspection, he realized he hadn't been giving his maximum effort. With that knowledge, his anger faded, and he resolved to talk with his boss. The result? "I had some discussions with him, and things went very well. I guess he was troubled about what he had done, and I was troubled about not working up to potential. Since then, things have been better for both of us." The key competence here is optimism, which hinges on how we interpret our setbacks. A pessimist, like the first executive, sees a setback as confirming some fatal flaw in himself that cannot be changed. The net result of such a defeatist attitude is, of course, hopelessness and helplessness. If you're doomed to fail, why try? Optimists, by contrast, see a setback as a result of factors they have the power to do something about, not to some flaw or deficiency in themselves. Like the second executive, optimists can deal with a setback by finding a positive response. Consider how optimism helps people recover from failure. Anne Bousquet, once head of American Express's Optima card division, was demoted in 1991 when five of her employees were revealed to have hidden $24 million in bad debt. Bousquet, though not responsible, was accountable, and so lost her position as general manager of the division. Though devastated by the setback, Bousquet felt a basic confidence in her abilities and rallied to another challenge she was offered at a lower level, salvaging merchandise services, a failing division for American Express. Optimists can more readily make a realistic assessment of a setback and admit how they contributed to it. Bousquet, for example, re-examined her perfectionistic, sometimes overly critical, management style, even considering that it might have cowed her employees into hiding losses. She underwent executive coaching to soften her style, becoming more patient and a better listener. And under her direction, the failing merchandising services division reached profitability within 2 years. Or take Arthur Blank, whose personality clashes with his boss at Handy Dan's, a Los Angeles hardware chain, led to his being fired in 1978. Blank's mother had kept the mail-order drug company his father had founded going after his death when Blank was young, and Blank himself, having witnessed how she overcame adversity, learned to keep trying instead of giving up when things went badly in life. So when an investor approached him, he jumped at the chance to found Home Depot, the no-frills, high-service, huge-selection home improvement chain that has grown to be a retailing giant. Arthur Blank didn't give up. He reacted like an optimist, using the insider's expertise he had acquired in his years at Handy Dan's to invent a business that could outcompete his former employer. He saw himself as having the ability to change things for the better. For an optimist, a failure is just a lesson to learn from for the next round. Mistakes are treasures, as a German manager put it to me, a chance to improve. But, he added, many managers have to realize they should be more tolerant of people's mistakes. Not punish them for it, but help them learn from it. Optimism and hope. Classic studies of how optimism bolstered sales productivity at MetLife, an insurance company, were done by Martin Seligman, a University of Pennsylvania psychologist. Seligman found that optimists sold 29% more insurance in the first year than did their more pessimistic peers, and 130% more their second year. The value of an optimistic outlook has been proven in many organizations. At American Express Financial Advisors, a pilot test of optimism training with financial advisors helped produce a rise in sales after just 3 months, big enough to convince the company to make it a standard part of training. Other studies of superior managers show that they look at their failures as due to a correctable mistake and take steps to ensure that the problem won't crop up again. The near cousin of optimism is hope, knowing the steps needed to get a goal and having the energy to pursue those steps. It is a primal motivating force, and its absence is paralyzing. Competent studies show that top performers in the human services, everything from healthcare and counseling to teaching, express hope for those they seek to help. The power of hope was shown in a study of caseworkers whose task it is to help people with the most severe mental disabilities, chronic schizophrenia, severe retardation, carve out a life for themselves in supervised homes. The first year in such jobs is the toughest. Clients don't get better. Things go wrong. People can be ungrateful. Caseworkers burn out and quit. But those caseworkers who were the most helpful, optimistic about their clients' potential for improvement and their own ability to help, fared the best. After a year on the job, those who began with high levels of hope survived with the most satisfaction, were less emotionally exhausted, and were most likely to stay in their jobs. In jobs like these, where stress is high and frustrations common, a rosy outlook may get better results. Hopefulness is crucial when anyone undertakes a tough task. Positive expectations may be especially beneficial in the toughest jobs, where high optimism may be a pragmatic job strategy. A caveat: there is something very American about these upbeat competencies. They reflect a frontier ideology that does not translate to all other cultures. In research done in a global food and beverage company among top executives, for instance, optimism was found to predict star performance in America, but not in Asia or Europe. In many Asian countries like Japan, Taiwan, and India, the can-do attitude is seen as too bold or too individualistic. Mary Fontaine, managing director of the Hay McBurr Innovation and Research Center, told me, "In those cultures, optimism typically manifests in more low-key ways, with the attitude, 'This is a very difficult challenge, and I'm trying, even though I may not be able to do it.' You don't hear people saying, 'I know I can do it. I know I'm good.' And in Europe, what Americans see as optimism can simply seem like arrogance." Part 3. People Skills. Chapter 7. Social Radar. The major account was underperforming, baffling the sales team at Johnson Wax. Why were the sales on a key product far softer there than at other retailers? The sales rep responsible for the account thought he knew the reason. The chain's buyer wanted to place bigger orders, but he was powerless. A battle between managers of two different departments at the retailer meant that the product was being sold in the wrong part of the stores, and so faring poorly. The department manager who was selling the product refused to give it up to the other department, and the buyer did not have the power to break the deadlock. To solve the problem, Johnson Wax's sales team called for the retail equivalent of a bilateral diplomatic commission, a meeting with three levels of executives above the sales rep and the buyer. At that meeting, Johnson Wax shared data with the executives from the chain, showing that if they handled the product differently, it could bring them $5 million more in profits annually. That hit home. When they saw they were passing up a $5 million opportunity because of battles between departments, they decided they had to break down the walls, says Patrick O'Brien, then vice president for North American sales. All three levels got behind the buyer. It had taken a year to have the discussion, but once they saw they wanted to do it, it took just days to make the change. That sales strategy exemplifies one of the marks of empathy, being able to see a sales situation from the standpoint of the customer in order to help the customer succeed. Such sensitivity demands being able to read the political currents and realities of someone else's organization. The best approach is to have a deep understanding of a buyer's business needs and objectives and work toward that end, O'Brien comments. The key is probing and listening to hear what's important for that person's success. It's been one of the fundamentals of sales success for the last century. When I spoke with O'Brien, he was flush with two triumphs. His sales team had just been named Vendor of the Year by both Walmart and Target, two of America's largest retail chains. One of the changing tides for retail sales is category management, where retailers at a grocery store, for example, will treat all their snacks or air fresheners as a single category and make judgments on which brands to carry collectively rather than on a one-by-one basis. Paradoxically, this by-the-numbers approach has made personal relationships between sales reps and category managers all the more important. Our sales stars have the ability to balance the world of fact with the interpersonal world, O'Brien notes. The sales profession has gone from rapport selling to number-based sales. The field has been shifting from the traditional social skills of sales to a model of managers who work their numbers, not their contracts. But you have to balance these. You need the interpersonal side because these are still individual decisions. Empathy takes many forms. One is the kind of astute awareness the people at Johnson Wax had of their clients' needs. But it can also be seen in the company that has a realistic, accurate sense of its own people, its customers and clients, its competitors and market, and other stakeholders, from unions to shareholders. Being able to see reality from their perspective to sense how they are reacting to the company's actions offers a powerful set of readings for effective management. The head of a private bank in Switzerland tells me, "My job is something like a family priest or doctor. You can't be in private banking without using your emotional intelligence, especially empathy. You have to sense what your client hopes for, fears, even if he can't express it in words." Empathy begins inside. As Freud observed, mortals can keep no secret. If their lips are silent, they gossip with their fingertips. Betrayal forces its way through every pore. The nervous fidgeting of a negotiator belies her deadpan expression. The studied disinterest of a customer dickering over prices in an auto showroom is contradicted by the excited way he gravitates toward the convertible he covets. Being able to pick up on such emotional clues is particularly important in situations where people have reason to conceal their true feelings, a fact of life in the business world. Sensing what others feel without their saying so captures the essence of empathy. Others rarely tell us in words what they feel. Instead, they tell us in their tone of voice, facial expression, or other nonverbal ways. The ability to sense these subtle communications builds on more basic competencies, particularly self-awareness and self-control. Without the ability to sense our own feelings, or to keep them from swamping us, we will be hopelessly out of touch with the moods of others. Empathy is our social radar. A friend tells me about her early sense of a colleague's unhappiness. "I went to my boss and said, 'Something's up with Kathleen. She's not happy here. She wasn't making eye contact with me. She stopped sending me her usual witty emails. Then she announced she was leaving for another job.'" Lacking such sensitivity, people are off. Being emotionally tone-deaf leads to social awkwardness, whether from misconstruing feelings or through a mechanical, out-of-tune bluntness or indifference that destroys rapport. One form this lack of empathy can take is responding to other people as stereotypes rather than as the unique individuals they are. At the very least, empathy requires being able to read another's emotions. At a higher level, it entails sensing and responding to a person's unspoken concerns or feelings. At the highest levels, empathy is understanding the issues or concerns that lie behind another's feelings. The key to knowing others' emotional terrain is an intimate familiarity with our own, shown in research by Robert Levinson at the University of California at Berkeley. Levinson has married couples come into his physiology lab for two discussions. A neutral, "How was your day?" talk, and a 15-minute discussion of something the couple disagrees about. During this small battle, Levinson records their responses in every way, from heart rate to changes in their facial expression. After the disagreement, one partner leaves. The one who stays then watches a replay of the talk while narrating the hidden dialogue of what he or she was actually feeling but did not express. Then that partner leaves, and the other returns to narrate the scene from the other partner's perspective. Partners adept at empathizing do something quite extraordinary physiologically. Their own body mimics their partner's while they empathize. If the heart rate of the partner in the videotape goes up, so does the heart rate of the partner who is empathizing. If the heart rate slows down, so does that of the empathic spouse. This mimicry involves a biological phenomenon called entrainment, a sort of intimate emotional tango. Such highly attuned rapport demands we put aside our own emotional agendas for the time being so that we can clearly receive the other person's signals. When we are caught up in our own strong emotions, we are off on a different physiological vector, impervious to the more subtle cues that allow rapport. Charles Darwin proposed that the twin abilities to send and read feelings have played an enormous role in human evolution, both in creating and maintaining the social order. In evolution, negative emotions, fear and anger, no doubt had immense survival value, impelling a threatened animal to fight or flee. In a sense, this evolutionary holdover is still with us today. During our own amygdala hijacks, we read and respond more strongly to someone else who is also in a bad mood than to someone in a good one. This can be a recipe for emotional disaster, creating a feedback loop of negativity or rage. The prerequisite for empathy is self-awareness, recognizing the visceral signals of feelings in one's own body. Among counselors, for instance, the most effective and empathic were best able to tune into their body's own signals for emotion, an essential for any job where empathy matters, from teaching to sales and management. A subtle dance. We had a woman who could clear a room in minutes, the marketing manager of a California-based educational software firm tells me. She wouldn't listen first and then join the conversation. She'd launch into a monologue, some complaint or attack that had nothing to do with what was being talked about, and she'd go on and on, oblivious to the yawns. She didn't know when to stop. She didn't have a clue. The smoothness in any social interaction depends to a great extent on spontaneous entrainment. When two people start to talk with each other, they immediately begin to fall into a subtle dance of rhythmic harmony, synchronizing their movements and postures, their vocal pitch, rate of speaking, and even the length of pauses between one person speaking and the other's response. This mutual mimicry goes on outside conscious awareness and seems to be controlled by the most primitive parts of the brain. These mechanisms kick in with breathtaking rapidity, as quickly as a 50th of a second. If this automatic coordination is missing, we feel slightly uncomfortable. One of the main mutual adjustments is in facial expression. When we see a happy face, or an angry one, it evokes the corresponding emotion in us, albeit subtly. To the degree we take on the pace, posture, and facial expression of another person, we start to inhabit their emotional space. As our body mimics the others, we begin to experience emotional attunement. Our nervous system is automatically set to engage in this emotional empathy. Again, the amygdala plays the key role in this attunement. But how well we use this capacity is largely a learned ability that depends on motivation. Animals and people who have been raised in extreme social isolation are poor at reading emotional cues in those around them, not because they lack the basic circuitry for empathy, but because, lacking emotional tutors, they have never learned to pay attention to these messages, and so haven't practiced this skill. Our first lessons in empathy begin in infancy, when we are held in our mother's or father's arms. These primary emotional bonds lay the groundwork for learning how to cooperate and be welcomed into a game or group. The extent to which we master this emotional curriculum determines our level of social competence. Take children on the playground who don't pick up the crucial cues for smooth interaction. When they want to join a game, they'll often just wade in and thereby disrupt it. More socially skilled children, on the other hand, wait and watch a while. They tune into the game first and then enter seamlessly at a natural opening. It's the same with adults. Picking up the social rhythm and timing of those we work with is essential. Because of differences in how well we have learned the basic skills of social awareness, there are corresponding differences among us in workplace competencies that build on empathy. Empathy represents the foundation skill for all the social competencies important for work. These include understanding others, sensing others' feelings and perspectives, and taking an active interest in their concerns. Service orientation, anticipating, recognizing, and meeting customers' needs. Developing others, sensing others' development needs and bolstering their abilities. Leveraging diversity, cultivating opportunities through diverse people. Political awareness, reading the political and social currents in an organization. Understanding others, sensing others' feelings and perspectives, and taking an active interest in their concerns. People with this competence are attentive to emotional cues and listen well, show sensitivity and understand others' perspectives, help out based on understanding other people's needs and feelings. An assistant at a large design firm describes the poisonous feelings emanating from a temperamental partner like this. With a glance, he became a closed door. He put up this "don't bother me" sign, so I knew to stay away from him. But if I have to deal with him at some of those times, I keep it short. I don't joke or anything. I did once, and he went nuts. So I get monotonic, almost moronic with him. The key phrase here is, with a glance, he became a closed door. That was the cue that told the assistant how to act around the temperamental design partner. At work, we constantly pick up such emotional cues and adjust our behavior accordingly. Lacking such radar, we are vulnerable to shipwreck in the shoals created by the rocky emotions of those we work with. Empathy is essential as an emotional guidance system, piloting us in getting along at work. Beyond mere survival, empathy is critical for superior performance wherever the job focus is on people. Whenever an artful reading of a person's feelings matters, from sales and organizational consulting to psychotherapy and medicine, as well as leadership of every kind, empathy is crucial to excellence. Medicine is a field newly awakened to the benefits of empathy, in part for some compelling economic reasons. In a day of heightened competition for patient loyalty, those physicians who are better at recognizing emotions in their patients are more successful in treating them than their less sensitive colleagues. Physicians, of course, need to sense the anxiety and discomfort of their patients so they can treat them effectively, but a study found how rarely they listen. Patients usually had an average of 4 questions in mind to ask, but during the visits, they were able to ask just 1 or 2. Once a patient started speaking, the first interruption by the physician occurred, on average, within 18 seconds. Physicians who don't listen get sued more, at least in the United States. Among primary care physicians, those who had never had a malpractice suit were shown to be far better communicators than their lawsuit-prone peers. They took time to tell their patients what to expect from a treatment, to laugh and joke, to ask the patient's opinion and check their understanding, and to encourage the patients to talk. And the time needed for a doctor to be successfully empathic? Just 3 minutes. Empathic design. Empathy has come to R&D. Researchers watch customers use a company's products, at home or at work, much as an anthropologist might observe another culture. This peek into the customer's world offers a fuller understanding than can be gained through the typical round of focus groups and market surveys. Such intimate exploration into a customer's life, combined with a company's openness to change, is a potent mix for innovation. When Kimberly Clark sent observers to watch parents and toddlers use diapers, they realized that toddlers needed a first step toward grown-up dressing. That insight led to the creation of Huggies Pull-Ups, which toddlers can pull on themselves, and to $400 million in annual sales before competitors caught up. The ability to read customers' needs well comes naturally to the best managers of product development teams. Being able to read what the market wants means empathizing with customers and then developing a product that suits their needs. At Ford Motor Company, empathic design was used in a makeover of the Lincoln Continental. The engineers, for the first time, were given intensive contact with owners of the car they were all trying to reinvent. Instead of the old method, where market researchers would lead focus groups of car owners and distill the results, engineers spent a week talking to people who had bought Continentals. Their task: get a felt sense of what owners loved about the car. Customers sense and feel distinctive qualities they value in a product, Nick Zanuck, then one of the project managers, told me. So we had to tune in to our customers' feelings. To do this, we had to be empathic. I told the design managers, forget about the data you've seen from market research. Go out and talk to the people we're building this for. Listen, feel, sense. Look into their eyes. Get a gut sense of what they want. This personal approach brought a strong sense of the customer into the room with the automotive engineers as they created their specifications. Zanuck remembers, they'd come back with a video of a customer and say, you can't see it, but right here he was feeling very strongly about what he was saying. We had to first get a sense of how all this needed to feel, and then figure out what that would look like in engineering terms, the technical specifications that would make the car feel comfortable or more responsive. The art of listening. When you're desperate to make a sale, you don't listen as well, the director of sales at a Wall Street brokerage firm told me. There's nothing better in selling than when someone objects to something and you can say, you're absolutely right. We should consider that. You do much better if you can listen and sympathize with their viewpoint. A finely tuned ear is at the heart of empathy. Listening well is essential for workplace success. The U.S. Department of Labor estimates that of total time we spend in communication, 22% is devoted to reading and writing, 23% to speaking, and 55% to listening. Those who cannot or do not listen come across as indifferent or uncaring, which in turn makes others less communicative. And listening is an art. The first step is giving the sense that one is open to listening in the first place. Managers with an open-door policy, who appear approachable or go out of their way to hear what people have to say, embody this competence. And people who seem easy to talk to are those who get to hear more. Listening well and deeply means going beyond what is said by asking questions, restating in one's own words what you hear to be sure you understand. This is active listening. A mark of having truly heard someone else is to respond appropriately, even if that means making some change in what you do. But just how far we should go in adjusting our actions based on what another says is itself a matter of some controversy. In sales circles, some view empathy quite narrowly, arguing that taking the customer's perspective will kill sales of products or services customers don't really want or need. This, of course, implies a somewhat cynical or naive view of the salesperson's task, as though it is only about making the sale, not building or improving a relationship with the customer. A more enlightened view of sales, though, sees the task as being able to listen well and understand what the customer or client needs, and then find a way to meet those needs. This lesson, that empathy is at the heart of effective selling, was borne out by a survey of a random sample of buyers for both large and small American retailers, who were asked about apparel sales reps. The old stereotype that sales go to the highly affable outgoing salesperson did not hold up. It wasn't enough to be a fast-talking extrovert. The buyer's consensus favored the reps who were most empathic, who cared about their needs and concerns. That was especially true if the empathy went hand in hand with the sense that the sales rep could be trusted. When empathy lacks integrity. I want to assure you at the outset that the most important thing is the kids. They come first. I know some of you are worried, but if we find anything that might harm the kids, we'll stop. So began the warm, reassuring presentation of the president of an outfit that specialized in recovering metals from the ash left by industrial burning. He had come to talk to the parents and teachers of a grammar school in the small town where his company was relocating. The plant would be down the street from the school, pending final approval by the town government. As the company president ran through what would go on at the plant, the jobs it would bring, the benefits for the local economy, his sincerity and concern for the well-being of the children and their community were winning over his audience. He seemed so understanding, so empathic. But then came the question and answer period. One of the parents, a chemist, asked, "But aren't you going to be processing ash that contains dioxin? And isn't dioxin highly carcinogenic? How will you protect our children from that?" With that question, the president became flustered, defensive, even antagonistic, especially when other parents, now not so trusting, challenged him on why he had failed to mention this unsettling fact earlier. The meeting ended with the parents deciding to consult an expert on industrial toxins and to ask the town manager to hold public hearings before approving the plant. Empathy can be used as a tool for manipulation. This manifests frequently as pseudo-empathy, a social pose that disintegrates quickly if recognized. A friend complained to me about the salespeople in a pricey clothing store she likes to browse in. "They always say how nice it is to see me and follow me around trying to make small talk. I just want them to leave me alone until I have a question." Then one day, in an unguarded moment, one of the salespeople confessed that her boss had instructed them to strike up a friendly conversation with customers who had made expensive purchases before. But this forced friendliness just didn't ring true. It actually put off my friend. We may have natural safeguards against such artificial empathy, the capacity to sense, as my friend did, when empathy is not sincere. And researchers who have assessed manipulative people find that those who are most motivated by a Machiavellian urge to use people for their own gain tend to be poorest at empathy. By contrast, those who are trusting, who believe that people are basically good, tend to be more highly attuned to feelings. empathy avoidance. Sam was emotionally tone deaf. He picked up the phone, heard a sobbing voice ask to speak with his wife, Marcy, and handed her the phone with a cheery, "Marcy, it's for you." Elaine Hatfield, the University of Hawaii psychologist who knows him, says, "Sam was oblivious to emotional messages because he couldn't care less. It's not enough to have the potential to empathize. We have to care. But some people who seem to lack empathy may actually be doing so strategically and intentionally. They may avoid caring in order to hold to a hard line and to resist the urge to help. And in the measure, this is not necessarily a bad thing in the workplace. Managers who go overboard in focusing on relationships or catering to people's emotional needs at the expense of organizational requirements perform poorly. In situations where the perceived cost of empathy is thought to be too high, for example, in a negotiation over wages, people on both sides of the issue may have to blunt their sympathy. Lawyers, too, are notorious for their studied indifference to the concerns of the other side during litigation, though, as we shall see in Chapter 8, an extreme shutdown of empathy is not a fruitful negotiation strategy. There may be some wisdom in tempering empathy, particularly when it comes to allocating tight resources in an organization. When we identify too strongly with someone else's need, we are more prone to go to extremes in helping them, even when that decision harms the collective good. By the same token, the head alone, without the heart, can make decisions that will backfire, as has been the case with many companies that ruthlessly downsized, then found themselves loathed or distrusted by the dispirited employees who were left. And some managers tune out the feelings of those they work with simply to avoid having to take those feelings into account, a tactic that can make them seem imperious or cold. A lack of empathy may account for what happened with the surgeon who was going to treat a friend for a blood clot in her leg. When he explained to her that one risk of the surgery was that she might lose her leg, my friend burst into tears. His response? "If you're going to cry, you'll have to find another physician to treat you." So she did. Empathy distress. She had been a pediatric nurse for 7 years, but now she was asking for a transfer to a different service at the medical center. Why? "I just can't take holding another little kid who is going to die of cancer. It's too hard on me." The nurse's anguish offers a case study in empathy distress, where one person catches another person's upset. Instead of helping the children out of their pain and distress, the nurse found herself joining it. Empathy distress is most common when we find ourselves deeply upset that someone we care about is in pain. For example, concern for a troubled friend, say a co-worker who fears being laid off, may stir the same troubling feelings in us. This phenomenon occurs when someone who is highly empathic is exposed to another person's negative moods and doesn't have the self-regulation skills to calm their own sympathetic distress. Medical residents toughen themselves to handle empathy distress. They're joking about patients near death as crispy critters or goners is part of this emotional shell, a way to deal with their own sensitivities. The danger, of course, is that they will end up like the insensitive surgeon who drove my friend away. A new generation of medical school programs has begun to teach students ways to manage their own distress more effectively without forfeiting empathy. Workers such as customer service representatives, who regularly deal with people in bad moods, are also in danger of empathy distress. This problem often plagues people in the helping professions, who are exposed day after day to people in dire circumstances. The alternative is to stay open to feelings, but to be adept in the art of emotional self-management so that we are not overwhelmed by the distress we catch from those we deal with. The politics of empathy. There is a politics of empathy. Those with little power are typically expected to sense the feelings of those who hold power, while those in power feel less obligation to be sensitive in return. In other words, the studied lack of empathy is a way power holders can tacitly assert their authority. During the days of the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr. expressed surprise at how little insight whites had into the feelings of blacks. Blacks, he said, had to be much more sensitized to how whites felt, if only to survive in a racist society. A parallel argument holds that, To the degree women are oppressed in a society, they have to be more empathic than men. For a review of the data on gender differences in empathy, see Appendix 3. Research in the 1970s and 1980s suggested a negative correlation between being in positions of power and empathic abilities. But that may hold less true today, since organizations are becoming more team-oriented and less stiffly hierarchical. The demands of modern leadership now include competence at empathy. The authoritarian style of the past just doesn't work as well as it once did. Those who still dismiss empathy as out of place in business, or as too soft, do so mainly because of two common misunderstandings. One is confusing empathy with psychologizing. The other is the mistaken belief that empathizing with people is the same as agreeing with them. Richard Boyatzis told me, "At a major computer manufacturer, I was assessing managers for empathy by asking them to describe a time they had helped someone with a problem. I found that some people would tell about deeply exploring the other person's psychological state and explaining it to them in terms of its childhood roots or some pop psych theory like codependency. But that is psychologizing, not empathy. You're actually dismissing the problem by talking about its supposed causes." Psychologizing, Boyatzis found, was related to mediocre performance in managers. The top performers listened and understood the other's feelings and offered advice, without imposing their own diagnosis of what was behind the problem. Such psychological theorizing may be of interest, even helpful, over a cup of coffee between friends, but it is not appropriate at work. And while it may masquerade as empathy, it is not the same. Similarly, understanding someone's point of view or perspective, knowing why they feel as they do, does not inevitably mean embracing it. Particularly in business dealings, understanding how someone feels need not lead to giving in, but to more skillful negotiation and management. As a result, tough decisions may generate less resentment and lasting ill will. I remember talking with leaders of management teams at Lockheed Martin, an aerospace company that had gone through a period of major cutbacks. Many of the managers had laid off hundreds of workers, a process some described as the hardest thing they ever had to do. I mentioned that some managers fear empathy will make them too soft-hearted to make the hard decisions of business life, and I asked them if they thought empathy mattered. "Absolutely," was one reply. "When you have to let thousands of people go, everyone else who stays is watching." They had to go through the layoffs despite the pain. But, they told me, if they hadn't gone about the process with empathy, it would have demoralized or antagonized everyone. Consider how employees were treated when plants closed at two companies. At GE, workers had 2 years' notice that the plant would be closed, and the company made an intense outplacement effort to help them find other jobs. The other company announced the closing with just 1 week's notice and made no effort to help workers locate other employment. The results? Almost a year later, the majority of the former GE workers said it had been a good place to work, and 93% lauded the transition services offered them. At the other company, only 3% said it had been a good place to work. GE preserved a large pool of goodwill, while the other firm left a legacy of bitterness. Developing others. Sensing others' development needs and bolstering their abilities. People with this competence acknowledge and reward people's strengths and accomplishments. Offer useful feedback and identify people's needs for further growth. Mentor, give timely coaching, and offer assignments that challenge and foster a person's skills. It was a small lesson, but one with lasting impact. As a high-profile, fast-track editor at a national magazine, she had a problem. "I was prone to snap decisions, committing to projects in a moment of enthusiasm, then having to suffer through a torturous series of rewrites with authors that ended in their articles being killed. It was emotionally draining for me, and it created too much animosity and just plain pain. But then, she told me, my editor-in-chief taught me a phrase that has helped immensely. What was that phrase? I'll think about it. That simple bit of advice exemplifies coaching, which lies at the heart of developing others. Excellence in this competence is emerging as second only to team leadership among superior managers. For sales managers, developing others is even more important, the competence most frequently found among those at the top of the field. This is a person-to-person art. The heart of coaching and developing is the act of counseling. And the effectiveness of counseling hinges on empathy and the ability to focus on our own feelings and share them. In a study of supervisors, managers, and executives in 12 large organizations, the impact of developing others was greatest among supervisors, suggesting that this skill is crucial in managing those involved in frontline work, salespeople, line workers, and the like. As the realm of a manager or executive's influence increases, the direct opportunities for developing others may diminish, while other competencies, like leadership, may emerge as more relevant. Even so, the head of an organization is essentially a teacher, Harry Levinson, a pioneer in consulting psychology, tells me. He adds, people these days need to have the sense they are getting increasingly competent as they go on, or else they won't stay. Strong coaching or mentoring helps employees perform better, enhances loyalty and job satisfaction, leads to promotions and pay increases, and lowers rates of turnover. An open, trusting relationship is the foundation of success in on-the-job coaching. That was the clear conclusion when 58 top managers, all vice presidents or above, at companies with annual sales of $5 billion or more, were asked about their own experiences. These executives focus on helping people they see as having high potential. As one high-level executive puts it, I'm nice to those whom I just expect to do their jobs, but I really lean on the talented ones. I push them to transcend themselves. They spent most coaching time trying to boost performance, mainly by giving feedback and offering tips on developing needed skills. By and large, their comments were positive. They spent only about 5% of their time confronting poor performance. The key to success as coaches? The best coaches show a genuine personal interest in those they guide and have empathy for and an understanding of their employees. Trust was crucial. When there was little trust in the coach, advice went unheeded. This happened also when the coach was impersonal and cold, or the relationship seemed too one-sided or self-serving. Coaches who showed respect, trustworthiness, and empathy were the best. But when employees resisted change or were difficult, then the experience was so unrewarding for the coaches that they tended to drop the effort. In retrospect, one of my biggest failures in business was not looking for coaching in my early years, a vice president at a large media conglomerate told me. I was so afraid to seem inadequate that I didn't ask for advice on how to handle things, so I shut down many potential coaching relationships. Now a young associate of mine will appear in my doorway asking me to coach her on how to approach our president about something or how to handle some situation. She's being smart. The standard image of coaching or mentoring is a seasoned hand helping a favored younger person along. But people who are gifted as helping others can do so with anyone, even superiors. Managing upward, helping a superior do a better job, is part of this art. A chief petty officer in the U.S. Navy, for example, recounted how he had to teach junior officers how to lead me. I tell them, you're running the ship, and I'm watching all this equipment for you. You've got a right to know how it's running. Ask me, and ask me to help you when I can. The art of the critique. When it comes to giving feedback, perhaps no one is better than Shirley DeLibro, head of the New Jersey Transit Authority, which under her direction emerged as the most efficient transit company in America. DeLibro shows people she appreciates them while giving them a consistent stream of positive and constructive performance feedback. I spend lots of time praising people. I send personal notes to people throughout the company when they do a good job, DeLibro told me. But I also let people know when they goof up. You do a disservice to people if you don't evaluate their performance honestly. You have to let them know what they need to improve. Like DeLibro, the helpful coach gives specific information about what is wrong, combined with corrective feedback and a positive expectation of the person's ability to improve. By contrast, the worst way to give feedback is during an amygdala hijack, when the result is inevitably a character attack. While that has a pernicious effect, so does another common failing, neglecting to give any performance feedback at all. In a study of the effects of performance feedback on self-confidence, MBA students either were praised, were criticized, or received no feedback on their performance in a simulation of creative problem solving. They had been told that their efforts would be compared with how well hundreds of others had done on the same task. Those who heard nothing about how well they did suffered as great a blow to their self-confidence as those who were criticized. The report cautions that when organizations deprive employees of specific job-related information, they may unknowingly inhibit their performance. People hunger for feedback, yet too many managers, supervisors, and executives are inept at giving it or are simply disinclined to provide any. And in some cultures, especially in Asia and Scandinavia, there is a tacit prohibition against expressing criticism openly, particularly in front of others. An executive at a Saudi company told me, "We have 27 different nationalities working together in our organization. Most come from countries where people were brought up not to say bad things about the people they work with. So it's hard to get honest performance feedback." On the other hand, giving brutal feedback can be a cover for pure competitive aggression, an attack disguised as helpfulness. An executive at a bank in the Netherlands says, "Some people here give feedback to score in a macho game of one-upmanship. They pay no attention to the impact on the person receiving it. They're far too blunt. But it's not authentic help. It's part of a game. They need more empathy." The power of Pygmalion. They were a burden on their shipmates, sailors who were constantly in trouble or simply did not do their jobs. Undermotivated problem sailors was the term the U.S. Navy used for them. The military acronym was LP, for low performer. But their supervisors were given a set of tactics to change the LP's behavior. The supervisors were taught something new, to expect the best of these low performers despite their abominable histories. The supervisors let the LPs know they believed in their ability to change, and they treated them more like winners. That positive expectation proved powerful. The LPs began to do better on every front, receiving fewer punishments, showing better overall performance, even improving their personal appearance. It was the Pygmalion effect in action. Expecting the best from people can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Athletic coaches and good managers alike have long known they can boost a person's performance by giving them a suitable challenge coupled with a vote of confidence. One way to promote positive expectations is to let others take the lead in setting their own goals, rather than dictating the terms and manner of their development. This communicates the belief that employees have the capacity to be the pilot of their destiny, which is a core belief held by those who take initiative. Another technique that encourages people to perform better is to point to problems without offering a solution. This implies they can find the solution themselves. Outstanding tutors use this strategy with their students. They initiate what amounts to a Socratic dialogue, leading the person through a series of questions. This lets students find their own way to the answers, which will bolster their confidence in decision-making. At a higher level of development, the coach or mentor arranges an ongoing assignment that will give the person needed training, experience, or challenges. This might take the form of delegating responsibilities, or putting the person in charge of a project that will call forth new skills. Doing this well demands a sensitivity to the readiness of the person being coached. If the assignment is too easy, little will be learned. If it's too difficult, the person may experience a setback. The skill lies in arranging successful stretch experiences that increase capability and confidence. The ultimate support comes in the form of promoting employees to appropriate positions, as a genuine acknowledgement of their newly achieved level of competence, and a new proving ground for yet another level of skill. Still, the urge to help develop someone's abilities can go overboard, conflicting with the better interests of the organization. Putting too much emphasis on coaching and development at the expense of other needs is a danger. Supervisors and managers who devote too much time and effort to coaching and too little to leading or managing end up doing a mediocre job at best. Service orientation. Anticipating, recognizing, and meeting customers' needs. People with this competence understand customers' needs and match them to services or products. Seek ways to increase customer satisfaction and loyalty. Gladly offer appropriate assistance. Grasp a customer's perspective, acting as a trusted advisor. To visit Stefan and Bernard, a clothing boutique on the island of St. Barts, is to experience customer service as high art. The eponymous owners attend visitors with a combination of Gaelic charm, wit, and undivided attention. For 2 hours one lazy January afternoon, my wife and I luxuriated in that attention. My wife and Bernard talked about her life and her clothes, with Bernard running back and forth to the racks to find her the perfect piece. But he also took 20 minutes to carefully annotate a map of the island for me, while regaling me with highlights of the island's restaurants, beaches, and snorkeling spots. My business is first of all to make people feel good here, to make everyone comfortable, Bernard explains, indicating their store, which crams clothes from 15 top designers into just 450 square feet. Their shop earns 5 times more per square foot than other such retailers, most of it in the 4 winter months of the tourist season. The key to this success lies in their philosophy of customer service. I have to know my customers to help them, how they like to dress, what they like to do, what part of their body they're dissatisfied with, Stefan tells me. They eschew the commission approach to sales, where the salespeople don't care if it looks good or not. They just want to make the sale. So they tell you that whatever you've picked is perfect, Stefan continues. If I don't like how something looks on a customer, I tell her so. And why? I don't want to sell her something that's not right for her. I act as an advisor to my customers. That is exactly what they are to their 300 or so regular customers. These clients are so familiar to them that when Stefan and Bernard travel on buying trips, many purchases are made with a specific customer in mind. We build relationships, says Bernard. We keep a complete file on each customer, follow what they bought, what they're looking for, and over the years, we help them build a wardrobe. Stefan and Bernard exemplify the highest level of customer service, which means being able to identify a client's real, underlying, and often unstated, needs, and then matching them to one's products or services. It also means taking a long-term perspective, and so sometimes trading off immediate gains in order to protect and preserve the relationship. The service ideal of top performers transcends the ordinary customer service model altogether. Sales or continued patronage is no longer the sole goal of the relationship, but rather a natural byproduct of servicing the client's needs. Superlative customer service entails being a trusted advisor, as Stefan and Bernard realize. This stance can mean occasionally taking a position that runs against the immediate interests of one's own organization, but is the correct action for the client. This kind of trust-based relationship will only grow over time. At the ultimate level of service, one acts as the client's advocate. This can lead to benefits in the long run. For example, advising a client not to overextend credit on purchases may mean fewer sales in the short term, but it ensures that the account will stay viable into the future. It might even mean, on occasion, suggesting a competitor's product, which may lose an immediate sale, but cement a long-term relationship. A broader view. In the modern organization, everyone has customers. Any colleague we need to assist or whose needs our own job affects is a client of sorts. Star performers go out of their way to make themselves available to serve their clients, especially during crucial moments. Stars also help their clients look good. For example, doing something that creates a visible success for the client or coworker. For those in the compensation and benefits arm of Sandoz Pharmaceuticals, outstanding customer service took forms like spending extra hours working closely with the head of sales to determine incentive targets, or giving a home phone number to a department head going through a critical